Hello everyone, and welcome once more to the History of Language podcast, where this episode is the second in our block of the Indo-European languages. Once again, my name is Clockwork, and I'll be your host and guide through languages over time. I do apologize if I sound a little funny this week. My recording was delayed due to an unforeseen illness. In this week's episode, we'll focus on one of the branches off of Proto-Indo-European, Common Germanic. This episode, because we're no longer starting at the base, we'll talk a lot about the changes that Proto-Indo-European went to become Common Germanic or Proto-Germanic, a description of the peoples that spoke it, and of course the broad details about the language itself. Let's set a timeline here for Common Germanic as it descends from the Proto-Indo-European language. Around the 3rd millennium BCE, the peoples that became the Germanic tribes settled southern Scandinavia, so the southern coasts of Norway and Sweden, as well as Denmark and northern Germany, from farther south in Europe. By the 2nd millennium BCE, the Nordic Bronze Age was well underway, giving rise to the earliest stages of the Germanic languages as separate from the rest of Proto-Indo-European around 3,000 years ago. The language spoken at this time is called Pre-Proto-Germanic. By the 500s BCE, the era of Common Germanic as we know it has begun, and into the first few hundred years of the Common Era, Germanic migration southward brought Common Germanic into contact with Celtic or pre-Celtic cultures and language. By the 3rd century CE, late Proto-Germanic speakers had expanded their territory significantly, spreading south and east and coming into contact with the Romans during the height of the Roman Empire. Now, the part where I would talk about the differences between Proto-Indo-European and Common Germanic gets a little confusing. The language didn't delineate neatly off of Proto-Indo-European, instead constantly morphing like drops in a bucket, rippling outwards and connecting in on itself in a series of changes over time. As such, I will talk about the broad changes in each stage of Germanic, going from Proto-Indo-European to Pre-Proto-Germanic, to Common Germanic to Late Proto-Germanic. I'll give the full change from Proto-Indo-European to Common Germanic where I can, and explain the full set of sound changes as I go. In Pre-Proto-Germanic, which can still be considered a dialect of Proto-Indo-European, the palatal velars, so kya, gya, and gya, merged with their plain counterparts, ka, ga, and ga. For example, gostis, meaning stranger in Proto-Indo-European, became gostis, became gastis, meaning guest. The vowel u, so u, was inserted before syllabic consonants, so kymtom, became hundang, meaning hundred. From late Proto-Indo-European, s was inserted after dental consonants when followed by a suffix which began with a dental, so Proto-Indo-European widtos became widstos, meaning certain. Geminate consonants were shortened after a consonant or long vowel, so continuing from a moment ago, widstos, became wissos, became wissas. Long vowels at the ends of words became overlong, so sehmo, became semo, meaning seeds. The laryngeals were lost at the beginning of words before a consonant, so dontum, became tanthung, meaning tooth. And they were lost before vowels, so H1 became E, hesti became esti, became isti, is. H2E became A, or whatever vowel falls elsewhere, so chenti, in front, became andi, in addition. H3E became O, or again whatever vowel follows elsewhere, so rero became oro, became aro, meaning eagle. After vowels while lengthening the preceding vowels. So, using the example from earlier, sehmo became semo, meaning seeds. If two vowels at syllable boundaries come together because of this, they become overlong. So the genitive plural suffix ohom became om, became all. At the ends of words, long vowels stayed short, so oh became o. But the laryngeals stayed between consonants. Then Cogwill's law. So H3 and H2 became G between a sonorant consonant and W. So Ugme became Ugwe, became Ungwe, became Unk, meaning us too. The remaining laryngeals became the unstressed vowel a schwa. So Pachter became Pater, became Fader, meaning father. Velars became labial before W. So Equos became Equos, became Equos, became Echwas, horse. In early Common Germanic, non-high short vowels, so e, a, and o, are lost at the ends of words, and this includes the sounds ya and wa. So tosio became tos, became thus, meaning of that. And then Grimm's Law, named after Jakob Grimm, the one who compiled all those German tales. The voiceless stops became fricatives unless another stop comes before it. So P became the bilabial voiceless fricative F. So Pachter became Father, became Father. T became Th. So Tod became Thod, became That, That. K became Ch. So Katus became Chathus, became Chathus, meaning fight. Qua became Hwa. So quod, became what, meaning what. The voice stops became devoiced. So ba to pa, da to ta, ga to ka, and gua to qua. And aspirated stops become voiced stops or fricatives. For example, bereti became beredi, became viridi, meaning he or she carries. And then Werner's Law, where voiceless fricatives become voiced when they come after an unstressed syllable. Then all words become stressed on the first syllable. Proto-Indo-European had a contrastive pitch accent, where stress and a higher tonality could change the meaning of a word depending on where it fell. Then a strange sound change happened, a labialized G, so gw, became B, b, at the beginning of words. So gwedjedi, she asks, became gwedjedi, became vedjedi, became vidjedi, he or she asks or prays. The sonorants, so nasals and L, assimilated. And W became NN, so tanchewich, meaning thin, became tanchewich, became thunwi, became thunni. LN became LL, so polchnos, became hulnos, became hullos, became fullas, meaning full. And this predated the contact with ancient Sami languages, because the word was loaned into Proto-Samic as polne, meaning hillock or mound. And ZM became MM, so hesmi became esmi, became emmi, became immi, meaning I am. The syllable owo became a long O when unstressed. The syllable eu became O at the beginning of words or before a consonant. Unstressed E became I except before R. And the syllable A became a long I, E. The syllable Yi became a plain I, so Ayeri, meaning in the morning, became Ayiri, became Airi, meaning early. Non-high back vowels, so O, and its long and overlong variants, and A, A, and its long and overlong variants, were merged. So Gostis, again, meaning stranger, became Gostis, became Gastis, meaning guest. In late Common Germanic, M at the ends of words became N, so tom, meaning that, became tham, became than, meaning then. M before dental consonants became N, so dekimt, became tehumt, became tehunt, became tehun, 10. N is lost after unstressed syllables, and the vowel before it became nasal. So ohom, the genitive plural suffix to an, to a, to all, eventually. The long nasal E, so E, is lowered to A. The schwa is lost between consonants, so samchados became samadas, became samdas, so sand. And it became A elsewhere, so pachter to father, meaning father. Word final T is lost after unstressed syllables, so again dekimt to tehunt, 10. And hwa became wa, or sometimes it just became ha. So snoighwos became snaihwas, became snaiwas, meaning snow. A long A became raised to O, so dohmos, to put a thing, became damas, became domus, meaning judgment. The same with overlong A, so again, sehmo, to sema, to semo, meaning seeds. And this change occurred after contact with the Romans, as Romani, the name of the Roman people, was borrowed first as Rumanis and then became Rumonis. And borrowings into Finnish also predate this change, as we can see in the Finnish loanwords hake, to seek, from sakia, which would become sokia, for example, or kavio, hoof, from the late Proto-Indo-European or pre-Proto-Germanic kapa, which became hova in late Common Germanic. Now we start to see umlaut, or vowel mutation, in its earliest form, when I and yod vowels and semi-vowels start quote-unquote coloring preceding words. Like dewos, meaning god, became Tewas, became Tiwas, a god in common Germanic religion, best known as his Old Norse counterpart, Tyr. E became I before a syllable final nasal, so N became in, meaning in, and Y is lost between vowels, but not after I or W. Vowels on either side contracted to form long vowels or diphthongs, so again, Ayeri in the morning became Ayiri, became Airi, early. N is lost before Ch, so Kyonketi became Chahidi, he or she hangs from something. And that was a lot of change. So who were these people that spoke this language, undergoing massive amounts of change to bring us the basis of German, English, Dutch, Norwegian, and so on? There were various tribes that spoke common Germanic, including the Angles, Vandals, the Danes, the Norwegians, Goths, the Ermininis, Franks, the Lombards, Saxons, the Utes, and the Svear. All of these tribes had their own dialects or groups of dialects, which would become the modern Germanic languages, though quite a few died out, like Gothic. The Germanics had kings, and they functioned not only as tribal leaders, but lawmakers, military leaders, judges, and high priests. Germanic kings were elected by the freemen of the tribe, from a pool of candidates of the royal family, who could trace their lineage back to the tribe's divine founder. Freemen ruled their own estates and paid fealty to no intermediate governing bodies between them and the king. However, a freeman without land could swear fealty to a man with land and property, who would in turn be responsible for his retainers. Germanic society and law had the Wehrgeld, or the price of a man's life. A freeman's life was worth 200 shillings or gold coins, whereas a nobleman's life was worth 6 times that amount, or 1,200 shillings. A man's status was directly associated with the number of cattle in his herd. Serfs, what were in essence slaves, had no Wehrgeld, and a price paid to their liege would be equivalent to that of property damage, or about 15 shillings. Not only was this the price of taking a man's life, either on purpose or on accident, it was also the deciding factor in fines for non-killing crimes. If I were a noble and someone insulted me, the fine would be higher than if I were a commoner, were we to settle the issue in a Germanic court. As an aside, the true crime in killing someone, and this carried on in various forms throughout Germanic cultures, was not being upfront about it, and in turn not paying the Wehrgeld or its equivalent. Murder didn't have the connotation that it does nowadays, but rather a murder was a secret killing. Violence was unfortunately a part of life back then. If a free woman were unwed, she would have the same Wehrgeld as her father. If wed, the same as her husband. Among the Alemanni, a tribe of the Upper Rhine in Germany, the Wehrgeld for women was actually double that of men. All freemen had the right to participate in assemblies called things, where legal disputes were settled and laws were affixed, upheld, or created. The Germanics were best known at the time for their warfare, though, not for their law. The Germanic peoples, as opposed to the contemporary Romans, did not have a standing army. As isolated as the tribes were, and because of how the lines of association were drawn, it was strictly impossible, though unusually charismatic leaders could sometimes assemble troops for longer periods of time, rather than a one-time band of irregulars. Because of this, the Germanic tribes excelled in raiding, not in protracted battles. Raids would often be conducted from tree lines, or a headlong rush into enemy lines if that were the case. Often, they were directed at neighboring, though unaffiliated, to the instigators, villages, and settlements. This strategy ultimately was less useful than it was against the Romans, their usual large-scale adversaries. However, the prominent battle of the Teutoburg Forest in 9 CE was so successful that it destroyed 3 Roman legions and forced the Romans to halt their conquest of Germania past the Rhine. And the Visigoths and Vandals did successfully organize themselves to such a degree that they were able to sack Rome twice in the 5th century CE. The Germanics used a variety of weapons in their warfare, spears, axes, javelins, and swords among other weapons, and in fact, the name of one weapon, a dagger called the Saxnut, gave rise to the name of a prominent Germanic tribe, the Saxons. Kinship amongst the Germanics was key to their identity as peoples. According to the Roman author Tacitus, it would appear that the Germanics were even aware of a shared kinship or ethnicity. However, the degree to which this is true, as with many things in history, is debatable. The family was an incredibly important unit among the Germanic peoples. All individuals were bound to both their father's and mother's side of the family, and while the father was considered the head of the household, women and wives were considered extremely important and authoritative, and in some cases, even considered to be magical. The Germanics had a polytheistic religion of their own until the medieval period, when most all of Germania had converted to Christianity. However, this was not a singular religion, and true on all counts. Even amongst its daughter religions, Germanic paganism and the stories and myths associated with it varied greatly from territory to territory. The best documented descendant of this is, of course, that of the Norse. I'll make sure to cover that, or at least the basics of it, when we get to Old Norse. The principal pantheon, collectively, is called the Ansiwis, descended as Æsir in Old Norse, or Æsa in Old English, with the singular forms Ansus in Common Germanic, Os in Old Norse, and Ås in English. The deities are Tiwas, the god of war. This is the ancestor of Old Norse Tyr, Old English Tiw, and is the cognate of the Greek Zeus and the Latin Jupiter. Jupiter, of course, has Pater, from the Proto-Indo-European Deus Pachter. Wodanas, the god of poetic inspiration and mania. This is the ancestor of Old Norse Odin, Old English Woden, and Germanic Votan. Frigyo, the wife of Wodanas. This is the ancestor of Old Norse Frigg, and is cognate with the Sanskrit word Priya, meaning wife. Frigyo was likely also addressed as Fraujo, meaning lady, and would in all likelihood become the Old Norse Freya. Fraujas, meaning lord, this became Old Norse Freyr. And Thunaras, thunder, best known as Old Norse Thor, also Old English Thunor, and Germanic Donna. The heavenly bodies may have also been deified, namely Sovilo, the sun, and Meno, the moon. Both of these show up in Norse myth as Sovelu and Moni, respectively. Now, how would these people have spoken, waged war, and worshipped their gods? Common Germanic, like its predecessor Proto-Indo-European, appears to be incredibly complex. Its word order, like Proto-Indo-European, was likely to be highly variable. It had 6 noun cases, 3 nominal genders, 3 numbers, singular, dual, and plural, 3 verbal modes, indicative, subjunctive, which it gets from the Proto-Indo-European optative, and the imperative. It had 2 voices, active and passive, the latter of which it receives from the Proto-Indo-European mediopassive. This grammatical system is quite like that of its close relatives, Latin, Greek, and classical Sanskrit around the 3rd century BCE. Its consonant inventory, after all of the sound changes detailed above, would have been something like this. The nasals, m and n. The stops, p, b, t, d, k, g, qu, and gua. The fricatives, f, th, and their voiced allophonic counterparts, v and th, s and z, ch, ch, and r and ch. The approximants, ya and wa, and the liquid, l, and the trill, ra. The vowels would have been e and e, oo and oo, e and e. However, these two could not occur in unstressed syllables, except before the trill r, and may or may not have already lowered to a by the late Proto-Germanic stage. It also had the long and overlong e and e, the long and overlong o and o, a and a, as well as the nasal vowels ing and ing, ung and ung, the long and overlong o and o, and finally ah and ah. It also had the diphthongs au, ai, au, and iu, as well as o and oi. The nouns declined in a way much like that of Proto-Indo-European, and 6 cases were retained by Common Germanic: the vocative, nominative, accusative, dative, instrumental, and genitive. By the time of Common Germanic, the Proto-Indo-European locative had merged with the dative, and the ablative could have merged with the dative or genitive. In either case, it went missing from Common Germanic. Common Germanic nouns declined according to their stem, the final vowel or consonant of a word root. Some of these stems were the A stem. So Wulfas, masculine, meaning wolf in the nominative singular, becomes Wulfans in the accusative plural, and Wulfai in the dative singular. The long O stem, so Gebo, feminine, meaning gift in the nominative singular, becomes Gevos in the accusative plural, and Gevomas in the dative plural. The I stem, like Mari, neuter, meaning sea in the nominative singular, becomes Maris in the genitive singular, and Marimas in the dative plural. and the R stem, used for close kinship terms. The words for father, mother, brother, sister, and daughter, but not son, as sunus was a U-stem noun. So, mother, feminine, meaning mother in the nominative singular, becomes modri in the dative singular, and modruns in the accusative plural. Common Germanic adjectives and determiners agreed with the nouns that they are paired with in case, number, and gender. Adjectives differentiated between strong and weak forms, with the former originally showing indefinite and the latter showing definite. For example, cow versus the cow to show definiteness. Common Germanic pronouns had first, second, or third person. In the first and second person, it had singular, dual, and plural numbers. In the third, just singular and plural. In the third person, they also accounted for masculine, feminine, or neuter gender, and they declined for five cases: nominative, accusative, genitive, dative, and instrumental. Here are some of the pronouns, and I've chosen examples that would be immediately recognizable and some that aren't if you're an English speaker. The first person singular nominative ek or ik, plural wees. The second person singular nominative thu and plural yous. And the third person singular nominative and accusative eat. And just for fun, let's go over the numbers in Common Germanic from 1 to 10. 1. Einas. 2. Twei. 3. Threes. 4. Feðvor. 5. Fimf. 6. Sechs. 7. Sevun. 8. Achto. 9. Nebun. And 10. Tehun. Now that all of that's out of the way, let's get into an example. Carrying over from last week's episode, we'll be going over Schleicher's fable, The Sheep and the Horses. Here it is, in Common Germanic. Awis echwozuch. Awis so wulon ne habde sach echwans, einanon kurianon wagnan teuhandun, einanon uch miki lo kuritho, einanon uch gmanum sneumando berandum. Awis nu echwamas sagde. Hirto sairi dimek, sehwande echwan sakandung umanu. Echwo sagde dun, gahausi awi, hirto sairi di un sehwandumis, gumo, fadisus awis wulo wurki di sis warman wastion, awis uch wulo nehabaidi, that hausi das awis akra flauch. So thanks for listening to The History of Language. I hope you enjoyed this look into the ancient ancestor of the Germanic languages. Next week, we'll cover the Northwest and East Germanic split, as well as the Gothic language. In the weeks following, we'll start to get into Pre-Old Norse or Common Runic, Anglo-Frisian, Low Franconian, and Old High German, before making our way towards the contemporary Germanic languages. After the Germanic branch, we'll cover the Celtic, Hellenic, Italic, Slavic, and Indo-Aryan languages, after which we will be done with Indo-European. After all of that, we'll make our way to the world's other major language families. So thank you again for tuning in. If you enjoyed the content, please consider liking our Facebook page, which you can find by searching for The History of Language on Facebook. And if you want to support future episodes, please consider joining my Patreon at patreon.com/historyoflanguage. I'll see you next week.